This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Hi, and welcome to this week's show. Hey, I want to do something totally different, and I need to beg your indulgence. My whole reason for being in the comedy business comes from my sense of humor, and that came from my dad. And I just need to share with you a little bit about my dad and how his life went and how maybe it affected me and my sense of humor. Now, my dad sadly passed away last year, but not that sadly. He had a great life and he did a lot of interesting things. But before he passed, I had a chance to interview him. Now, it was about a 90-minute interview, and it was really mostly just to get on record his life story. But because my sense of humor came from him and our appreciation of comedy, I thought I'd share with you a few minutes of his life as he would tell it. This will be about 20 minutes, and then like every other podcast, I'll end it with some great stand-up comedy, and this week featuring my dad's favorite stand-up, Pat Paulsen. So I know you'll enjoy that. So sit back and listen to the funny ramblings of my dad as he talks about his life from early schoolhood in through the Army and a job after that. And I hope you find it interesting. It's certainly got some nice historical pieces, and I think it's kind of funny. So ladies and gentlemen, sit back and enjoy this podcast as it starts right now. One of the reasons that I ended up going into comedy and Laughs Unlimited was that I was raised by a very funny guy who had a great sense of humor. As a traveling salesman, he was always quick with a joke and always shared lots of funny moments with me in my life. Yes, my lifelong buddy, my father, Sprague Edward.
Yay!
Well, and the crowd goes nuts. Hey, welcome to the podcast, Dad. How you doing?
Just fine, thank you.
And it's good to be able to chit-chat with you a little bit. We have known each other a long time. And
most of your life.
Yeah. And I just wanted to get an opportunity to share with the podcast listeners about where I came from, and that means how I was raised in a somewhat funny environment, or at least appreciative of comedy and entertainment through you.
Junior high school was very interesting. We were always in trouble. Every morning we had to go to the dean of men and get swatted with a fraternity paddle. But he let us put stuff in our back pocket so it didn't really hurt much.
But that's kind of nice of him.
Yeah. But our gym teachers, there was a guy named Mr. Patrick, and he hits you with a fraternity paddle right as you get out of the shower, and that really hurt.
Wow. Corporal punishment in school. Those were the days. I should point out to everybody, my father turned 89 a few months ago. So these memories go back to a time when they didn't have the rules and concerns they have in the public today. But corporal punishment lasted well into my school years. Going to Catholic schools, you could get swatted by a ruler here and there, but never a big paddle. So I guess it got lightener, lightener, and lighter. Now I think they just put kids in the corner, which is really no punishment at all because they take their phone and they're entertained.
And they have to wear a little dunce hat.
Yeah.
One thing was sort of fun. He got a job. His mother was a nurse in this doctor's building. It's 10 stories high. She got him a job as the elevator operator. So we used to go down the basement and play cards and horse around until the bell rang. And then Dick would jump into the elevator and just take it up. And there's a bar across the bottom of the elevator. One of us would grab the bar and go up till wherever it went up. And then the only problem he had was be sure to jump off before the elevator pushed it into the ground.
Oh, wow.
But it was kind of fun. And
scary, but fun.
Oh, yeah.
Crazy high school kids.
Oh, well, yeah. But Sellers' mother worked for the state of California Employment Office, and she said one day this wizened little old man came in and said, "Do you know any young men would like to go to sea?" And she said, "I know one," her son, you know. And he said, "Well, I need three." So I was only 17, so I had to get my parents' permission. And one thing I give my parents a lot of credit for is they gave me an awful lot of freedom. And in other words, they figured out that I could take care of myself and I wouldn't embarrass the family or anything, whatever I did. And
they supported you, which is nice.
Yeah, well, they didn't. Yeah, until I was 17, then they got the hell out of there. But anyhow, we got a ship. Now, there's a trick there. You have to have to get a ship, you have to have seaman's papers. To get seaman's papers, you had to have a ship.
That's kind of a catch-22.
Right. So we had a ship. So we ran over to the Coast Guard and got our seaman's papers as an ordinary seaman. And went on board and spent about a month cleaning the ship up. And then we decided it was time to go to sea. So we went over to get some scientists and students of oceanography and stuff like that on board. It was a survey ship for the Fish and Wildlife Service in the Department of Interior. It had been a three-masted schooner, so it had this huge hull on it made what do they call the thing on the bottom?
It's the hull.
No, that's the...
The rudder, the... I'm not a boat guy, sorry.
But it was steel, and it was still on the boat. And of course, originally it was a beautiful three-masted schooner, and the Navy took it over during World War II, chopped the forward mast and the aft mast off, cut the mizzen mast in half, put a house on it, two diesel engines in it. We still had the keel.
Ah, there you go. Yeah. You had the steel keel,
yeah.
And the military converted it from a sailboat to a powerboat.
Right. And so anywhere a wave came within 30 miles or so, the boat would just rock like crazy. And of course,
without that keel.
Lots of waves in the ocean. Anyway, we headed for the Chevron docks to fill up with fuel, and Sellers was at the wheel, and the captain was standing next to him. And as we're hit probably about 5 or 6 miles an hour or knots per hour, we're heading for the Chevron dock. And I can see Dick arguing with the captain about, don't we think we should put it in reverse? And I guess he said no. So I saw we were going to hit the dock, so I laid down on the deck so I wouldn't fall and get knocked down. And we hit that sucker, and asphalt and timbers and everything was flying. Everybody on the dock went running for land, and it was a real fiasco on it for our very beginning trip.
Well, that's interesting because I knew you were in the Merchant Marine, but I guess not being hearing the stories in a chronological, I thought it was after your time in Korea during the Korean War as a paratrooper. So you were actually a teenage seaman,
right,
in the Merchant Marine. And then, okay, so you did that for how long?
1 year.
1 year.
And one of the most exciting things was I'm 17 years old now, and I'm at the wheel, and we hit a hurricane. And
I got to ask, why would they let 17-year-olds drive the boat?
Because that's my job.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
A regular seaman first class could still steer the boat? There must be a captain on deck.
There's an officer and two seamen on each watch, and we switch off on who was steering.
Oh, anyway, wow.
I was steering, and
it's a lot of responsibility.
Well, he comes up with this hurricane, and the captain comes over and says, "For God's sake, Edwards, don't get in a trough or we'll be swamped."
Okay. Wow, that's a lot of pressure.
Well, it's 30-foot waves, and I look out the window. All I saw was water, and then we get up to the top of the waves, and all I see was sky, and we had this big picture window. It was a little unnerving, but eventually it died down, and we just followed it rather than trying to battle with it. And when it calmed down enough, we turned around and went back to where we were supposed to be. 1950.
Okay, so television had started, but was not a household thing yet.
Oh, heck no.
And still black and white and small, and only rich people had them.
I think that's one of the reasons I married Marilyn, because she had a television.
So you married my mom because she had a TV?
Yeah,
ouch.
Oh, we got to watch a real funny Jewish guy.
Milton Berle?
Milton Berle.
Yeah.
They were close. Merle and Milt.
No, that's good. Milton Berle, yeah, was huge in radio. And then he was one of the successful people, him and Red Skelton and a few others that were able, Bob Hope, to convert over to TV.
Right. That wasn't the reason I married her, but it was a pull.
So now you're in junior college. What? Where'd you go after that?
Well, that's when the Army wanted me.
Oh, and were you drafted?
No. They wanted to draft us. Well, I said, well, we got to go somewhere. And I said, let's go to the Navy. I mean, I really love the ocean. Chuck said, oh, no, I'll get seasick. So we had a lot of friends that were in the 82nd between wars. They had to train in gliders, which wasn't much fun, plus jumping. And they said, the food was pretty good. And being the nation's top branch of the service, it was fun. You get to march in a lot of parades. So we went down and joined the Army, specifying we wanted to go on the airborne. And then that Monday, we were in Fort Ord getting processed. The draft board called and wanted to know where the hell we were. And the school wanted, we also enrolled in West Contra Costa, so we'd be in school
right, to
make the transfer. And they wanted where we were. And my mother said, well, he's in the Army. He can't be in the Army yet. I've already been in for 2 days.
Anyway, you beat them to the punch.
Yeah, and which is really smart. We got processed in Fort Ord, and what was sort of interesting there, we had about 100 guys take this your different tests to see if you could read and write and stuff. And there was 100 guys there, and then they wound up with 8, and then they wound up with 2, and I was one of them. And
so you were the smartest of the bunch.
Well, no, there was another guy just pretty much as smart, I think. But I wasn't really very smart, I didn't think, but there's a lot of people that are really dumb.
Process of elimination, Dad.
Yeah.
So what did those last two, meaning you and one other guy, end up doing?
Well, they asked us if we want to go to OCS,
Officer Training School?
Yeah.
Wow.
Mechanics School. And all I could think of was John Wayne in the jungle with a bar on the front of his helmet, looked just like a good target, saying, follow me. And I said, no thanks, I'll stay enlisted. And plus, you had to stay another 6 months in the Army. And when you're 18, it seems like...
That sounds like forever.
Seems like forever, yeah. But I probably should, because in real life, you do a lot more things that you do in the Army as an officer than you do as an enlisted man.
More opportunities.
Well, there's more things, you have more responsibility and more things to do. You don't have to just dig holes. And I've got a picture somewhere in a foxhole, and I look like I'm about 12 years old with this steel pot rattling around on top of my head. And I was thinking, boy, if I was an enemy, I'd head for me. I didn't look very threatening.
You weren't too intimidating, huh?
I wasn't intimidating at all.
But you had signed up in the airborne as a paratrooper, and that training must have been interesting.
Well, that was really interesting. But we had to spend 16 weeks taking basic training.
Mm-hmm.
When we first got there, they were so short of supplies and stuff. I had to wear my civilian shoes for about a month before they got an A size 12 shoes.
Wow. Oops. Now, where was this? Was
Fort, this Fort Roberts.
Fort Roberts.
Camp Roberts.
Where's that located?
San Luis Obispo.
Yeah, okay. I've seen it.
It's Paso Robles, actually.
I've been by there, yeah.
All summer, it never went below 100.
Wow. It's interesting. I've driven by there several times. And in fact, Jill, my wife, by the way, who's in the government service, had a meeting there. And so we were actually on the base, and I didn't know your connection with it.
I lived there for almost 4 months.
Wow.
Well, 4 months, 16 weeks. And I thought these were kind of interesting. The first day we were there, they asked who had a B uniform, which is like they had an A uniform, which was the best, and a B was pretty close, and then the rest were fatigues. And I said, that can't be a bad job. Chuck, let's volunteer for it and we'll get extra points. So we did. And they took us a little PX, gave us an unloaded M1s, and said no more than 10 people can come into the PX at a time. Well, just about ready at quitting time, here comes a company of guys who've been out in the field for, I don't know, a week or so. And this corporal who was in charge came up and said, of course, we didn't even know how important a corporal was. He said, my men are hungry. I says, well, they have to come in 10 at a time. That did not go over too well. And next thing you know, we were sort of overwhelmed. We broke a ping pong table.
Oh, you tried to physically stop them?
Yeah.
Well, that was your job.
With a blanket, an empty M1. We could have shot in the air, scared them. But anyway, they beat us. And they got in. So that was rule number one, don't volunteer.
So you thought it'd be a cool job. You ended up getting run over by company of soldiers.
Wait for the best. At the end of basic training, the last thing they do is something called close combat drill. And you march along in a single file with loaded rifles. And targets would come up on either side of you. And you're supposed to shoot at them if they're bad guys. Well, it was about 6 o'clock or 6:30 in the morning and cool. And I says, Chuck, let's volunteer, go first. So we did. And we came back. Guy says, well, you did such a nice job. You can take the rest of the team through, the rest of the company through. We went, had to each of us go through there 5 times. Guys shooting at each other. I mean, they're really half-wits. And he said, no, do not point the gun at the guy in front of you. It's on the sides. Promise.
And you were somehow in charge of this motley crew?
For 5 times, different times.
Oh, jeez. And again, because you volunteered.
Yes. Don't do it. But I thought it was a chance to go through before it got real hot. And we wound up going through 5 times.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I know you learned how to jump out of a plane and you learned how to fall, which you taught me and I know saved you several times. How many jumps as a paratrooper did you make?
11. 5 in jump school and then 6 in my regular outfit. But one of them was really exciting.
Yeah?
They wanted me to go to school in Fort Harrison. Well, they like to send me to school because if I got good grades and stuff, that reflected well on the company. And so they always were trying to send me to schools. Well, they sent me this one in Indiana at Fort Harrison. My boss said, well, you know, we have to go jump before you go. And I said, no, I'll jump back when I get back from class. No, you got to jump before. There's only one plane going up, and it's a test jump on the new parachute called the T-10. Well, they have to test the chute at 150 knots. Normally, we jump at 100 knots.
Wow, so this was a high-speed jump.
Well, 145 was the last one. And so we all get in this plane and put the chutes on, hook up, and we're sitting there. And they take 2 dummies, 150-pound steel dummies, and both of them malfunction.
Oh, that's a little...
Not a good sign.
That's intimidating.
I think I was the second guy out on my side, and the guy in front of me was a smaller man, and he blew right back into the plane. I'm looking at him, and he kind of finally rolled out, and boy, I really jumped hard so I could get out.
You actually get out of the plane.
I didn't want to go back in.
Now, you weren't very old at this point, were you?
No, but I was, you know, I've been in 2 years.
So how old were you? Last we checked, you were 17. Playing football, are you now about 19, 20?
19, 20. No, I mean, 20, 21, and 22 in the Army.
Okay, so pretty young, though, but that's when a lot of people join the service. Wow.
First 6 times ever in an airplane, I jumped out.
That makes no sense.
Well, flying was a big deal then, you know.
Right. So you made it through, you survived through the service.
Oh, yeah.
And then once you graduated, did you jump into sales?
Yeah. Well, what happened was there was a company called IBM. It was just getting started. They had card things and stuff. And I thought they'd probably go someplace, so I really was interested in interviewing with them, and I did. And the guy said, are you in the top 10% of your class? And like a fool, I said, I don't think so. I work full-time, I'm married, and I have a child. And, but I should have said, yes, they probably never would have checked.
Right.
So I found out that the oil companies paid $3.95 a month and regular businesses, Ford and regular other kind of business, paid $3.50. Well, with a child and another one on the way, I figured $3.95 was better than $3.50.
Well, and I think that was what was fun for me was introducing you to the various comics. You mentioned we went to lunch once with Gary Shandling, and you got to meet Seinfeld before he had his show, and the list goes on and on. But what's interesting is because I have a respect for the history of comedy, and I think that comes from you, and I don't know if you remember, but it was because of you I booked Pat Paulson. And I brought Soupy Sales in, and some of the classics of comedy that weren't really, I mean, they were stand-ups, but not really. Soupy Sales wasn't really a stand-up, but, you know, had an act. And, of course, Pat Paulson, the perennial presidential candidate, and we ended up being really good friends. But that was kind of my homage to you. These were people that you respected and liked in comedy.
Thank you very much. But they were funny.
Yeah, no, they were definitely funny. And then I know that I had a chance to invite you to Tahoe once, and we hung out for a whole day and a night with Harry Anderson.
That was one of the best nights of my life, really. He was just a delightful man. And even his opening act, what was his name? Sinatra.
Sinatra?
Yeah. The opening act for the show in Reno.
Uh-huh.
The guy's name was Sinatra. Not Frank.
Not Frank.
No, not even Frank Jr.
It was just some guy named Sinatra. Yeah. Was opening up for Harry Anderson.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. I don't remember that.
Well, see, there you go.
Yeah.
It's the mind.
Yeah, well, he introduced me to Turk Pipkin and Jay Johnson. And Jay Johnson, the ventriloquist from soap and other TV shows, was a regular co-act with Harry Anderson on the road, along with Turk Pipkin, who was a juggler and comedian. But we had a chance to run into him and spend an evening with him. But I think it was really fun for me, and maybe just out of trying to, you know, make your dad proud of you or make your parents happy. It was always great to have you visit the club and be able to see not only me on stage, but the talents that we did. So thanks for being around for that.
I knew he was always faking it.
Who?
You. Oh.
What do you mean I was faking it?
No. Yeah, I'm just absolutely amazed. He and Bob Stovner and a guy married to a girl named Fawn.
Mac and Fawn. And Rich Giannichini.
Yeah. Started with absolutely nothing. They went in the basement of the firehouse, which is a fancy restaurant in Old Town, and they made a club out of a basement full of pipes of holding up the upstairs.
Yeah, it was an interesting time, and it led to something. But it really came from being able to share what was, I thought, important to me in my thrill of entertainment and comedy with what you raised me with, which was a good sense of humor. You know, I'll give you a quick analogy. Mom was always into painting and gardening. And for whatever reason, as an adult, I have no talent at all, but I have a real appreciation of art, which led me to own several art galleries. And I still have kind of a green thumb when it comes to gardening. So, I mean, I picked up things as a child that stayed with me through my adult years. So thank you for that.
I've always had a black thumb.
You couldn't keep anything alive?
No.
One of the trophy companies you worked for did the Oscars, right?
I got the Oscar contract.
You did?
That's my claim to fame, yeah.
Wow. Why don't we tell the audience about that? Who were you working for?
R.S. Owens. The guy's name was Owen R. Siegel, but he didn't want a Jewish guy to be running a company, so he named it
R.C. Owen.
Yeah.
And it was a trophy company.
Right. It's been there forever. They were the second guys to start making little golden idols and, you know, baseball players.
Right,
stuff
right.
Like that. And the first guy was a guy named Ray Dodge, and I worked for them first. And I thought this is sort of interesting. They had kind of crappy stuff because it was all from, you know, like the 30s. You know, there was the catcher and the model for the catcher was a real heavy set guy. Anyhow, I answered an ad to sell sporting goods. And it was run by these couple of guys from Harvard who set up a shell company and decided to get into sports. And so they were looking for salesmen for sports. And I thought, yeah, it'd be like Wilson or something like that. Wrong. Trophies. I didn't even know they sold trophies. And they had bought Dodge Trophies, which was the original trophy company. You know, had that all sort of set up, but they didn't know how to sell the stuff. And so I got a job with them. And I worked for them for, I guess it was 2 years or so. And one of my competitors worked for Owens. And he was a nice guy. And he was married to a beautiful girl. And they live in Dana Point in Southern California. And she sold real estate. So when he was home on the weekends, she was selling real estate. When he was on the road, she was sitting around the house. She met some guy who was an airline pilot and thought he was kind of attractive. So my friend got really nervous, and he told the owners of Owens that he was quitting. And they said, is there anybody out there you could recommend? He says, well, I don't know, but there's a guy named Sprague Edwards. Either he had just been there or he was coming right after me. Everywhere I went.
Oh, so you guys had the same territory and were running into each other all the time.
Not very often, but I always sent cards out saying I was coming and stuff. So they called me up, and I was with Dodge. I was getting $250 a week draw, and always made much more than my draw. And then they called me up and said, would you consider coming to work for us? I said, I don't know. I don't know anything about you, except that you make trophies. And they said, well, we'll fly you back here. We'd like to show you around. So I flew back there, and they showed me around the plant and everything. We went in the office, and he says, what do you think? Would you like to come to work for us? And I said, $500 a week. He says, we don't pay anybody $500 a week. I says, okay. And I started to walk. I said, would you take $450? I said, in a heartbeat.
Wow, and that's a huge increase. Reminding from the beginning of this, when you're making $395 a month, you know, now you're making $450 a week. Then
that's just a draw, you know.
Yeah, and you were making more.
I still made more.
So how did you get the Oscar contract?
Well, it came open or something, and Owen called me in, and he says, would you make a presentation to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science? I said, I'd be glad to. He said, if you get the contract, I'll give you $1,000. Well, what I should have said, if I get the contract, give me 2% of sales.
Right, right.
But I didn't even think of it. $1,000 seemed like fun. So I went down, made the presentation, got the contract.
Wow.
76, I think it was.
Wow, 1976, you took over the Oscars and brought the trophy manufacturing to R.C. Owens. That's a great success story, Dad.
That's my
claim to fame, you say.
Claim to fame, right.
Well, I think you've had several, including having me. But I think selling the Oscar to the Academy Awards. Now, does R.C. Owens still make it, or do you know if...
They lost it this year.
This year they did. Uh-huh. So because of your sales pitch from 70...
I think it was 76.
76 to now is all R.C. Owens, you doing the Oscars. So congratulations. Oh, we should, yeah, that's incredible. The Oscars. Yay. Well, that was an interview with my father, and I hope you got something out of that and enjoyed it a little bit. I certainly am appreciative of the fact that I had the opportunity to share that time with him. As I mentioned, it was about a 90-minute interview I did with him, and I kind of chopped it up and tried to just present what I thought was interesting or funny. And thank you for indulging me and listening to that. But hey, as I promised, we always have stand-up comedy on this show. So coming up right now is a short set from one of my father's favorite comics. He ended up being a good friend. I spent time in his, worked with his daughter a lot. And it was a real joy to be a part of his life. Ladies and gentlemen, sit back and enjoy the amazing comedy of Pat Paulson.
I'm very excited to be here. I'd like to talk about the challenges we face in this election year. As I travel this great land, I hear complaints about auto workers being laid off, cheap imports, steel mills closing, the garment industry dead, foreclosures of farms, the homeless, pollution, problems of the aged, the threat of AIDS, child abuse, Middle East, Nicaragua, etc., etc. I hear these rumblings of discontent everywhere I go, and you know what I think? I think America ought to just shut up. I'm sick of this bitching and moaning. If you don't like what's going on, get off of your butts and find somebody to take care of these problems. Look at the men you have running now. Men who say they have a new vision, a new idea. On the Republican side, George Bush. Now here's a man who was envoy to China, chairman of the Republican Party, an ambassador, a congressman, head of the CIA, vice president. Man cannot hold a job. George Bush is kind of like Jerry Ford without the pizzazz. And Dole, do you want a pineapple for president? Pat Robertson, God told him to run, which proves one thing. God's got a great sense of humor. Pat doesn't have a prayer. On the Democratic side, we have Gary Hart back in the race. Now, Gary Hart gave new meaning to the old expression, walk softly and carry a big stick. I'll tell you one thing, you'll never catch me fooling around. Jesse Jackson, handsome, well-dressed man, magnetic speaker. Dukakis, where'd he get that name, off the bottom of an eye chart? Dukakis, what a name for president. I mean, where are the Washingtons and the Jeffersons and the Johnsons? Well, they're playing basketball, most of them. I think it's time we started looking for someone else to lead us, a man who will conduct his campaign in a decent, honorable way, with a little hoopla. Man, where we find him? Where is he and what is he doing? He may be a friend of yours, an acquaintance. He might be right here in Hollywood this very moment. He could be in this audience, standing on this very stage. I don't know where he is.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.